Dave Ross. It has been a week since we learned, courtesy of the New York Times, that somebody had been going into the Coeur d'Alene Public Library and taking the anti-Trump books from their proper places in the stacks and hiding them in various places. Not stealing the books, but either hiding them or turning them so that the spine was facing the inside of the shelf so you couldn't see the title of the book. Apparently it's some kind of protest. Betty Ammons is, I guess, as director of the Coeur d'Alene Public Library, you're sort of the lead detective here. So have there been any developments in your attempts to find out who's been doing this, Betty?
There have not. We continue to search for books that are missing. Sometimes we find them buried in the fiction when they should be in the nonfiction. It seems to have tapered down, but we're always on the lookout.
Some of the titles of these books include Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents, Fire and Fury Inside the White House. I remember that one. And Stephen Colbert's Whose Boat Is This Boat? And I have me watching The Colbert Show, and he has apparently offered to give you a giant-sized copy of his book so that anyone who tries to hide it could not possibly hide it because it would be so large. And you do carry large print books, do you not?
We carry large print books. We don't carry large print books, but we're looking forward to seeing it.
So did you have any indication that this is, in fact, a protest of some kind as opposed to simply a juvenile prank?
Well, we actually did receive a note from the person who's hiding books telling us that they were protecting young people from books that were against the president. So we had been missing books for quite some time, and when we received that note, we had an aha moment. Oh, that's what's happening.
How long had this been going on?
Since summer of 2018.
Oh, my gosh. The New York Times story drew a connection to Coeur d'Alene's history of hosting white supremacist groups, but none of them has claimed responsibility then.
No. And I really don't think this has any more to do with that than just somebody exercising their political viewpoint.
Oh, so you don't think there's a link between this and the white supremacist groups then?
I don't.
You don't sound, I mean, it's an inconvenience, but you don't sound terribly worried.
Well, what worries me is the cost to taxpayers, the time library staff spends searching for books, ordering replacement books, and then ultimately finding books. And what also worries me is that it just keeps library patrons from access to those materials. So that's worrisome, no matter what the content of the hidden books is.
Yeah, but it has also certainly made your library one of the most famous libraries in America now.
Well, we didn't expect that, but you are absolutely right. And we're receiving such good wishes and comments from all over the world. And I have to say, the donations have really started pouring in.
Really? Donations of books?
Yes, and money.
Oh, not bad. So what kinds of books?
Not bad.
I'm curious, what kinds of books are they donating? Are they replacing the anti-Trump books with more anti-Trump books?
Yes.
So I guess it's safe to say that this whole thing has backfired. Unless maybe, you never know, there's some very clever pranksters these days. Maybe they are actually anti-Trump people who knew that this would in fact spark an outpouring of anti-Trump feeling.
Well, that would be the long game for sure on this.
I know. That's probably too clever by half. Actually, I'll tell you this. If it is a promotional gimmick, it's pretty ingenious because I can see that there is a certain portion of your clientele which appreciates a good treasure hunt. And I would imagine that these days people actually are purposely visiting the nooks and crannies of the library to see what might be there, aren't they?
That might be the case. And I also imagine there'll be a lot of people looking for copies of Rick Riley's book, Commander in Chief, because he's coming here to speak and he's planning on hiding 10 copies of his books throughout the library.
So this has, in fact, become a major draw now.
It has. And, you know, I do think there's that humorous side of it, but I also love the fact that people get it. They understand that libraries provide books for all kinds of readers. And anything that brings that to the forefront, you can't be upset about it.
Just to make set the record straight, do you indeed have pro-Trump books? Do you have Sean Hannity's book and Laura Ingraham's book and books like that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, you know, the Dewey Decimal System being what it is, those books are shelved next to each other in the 973s. And our intention is if we do receive the big book from Colbert, we plan on a display that would feature books on all kinds of things.
Betty Ammon is the director of the Coeur d'Alene Public Library. Betty, thank you very much. Good luck. And if you do find the culprit, please let us know as soon as you can.
I will. Thanks very much.
Dave Ross with Lisa Brooks, who's in for Colleen and Chris, and here's Hannah. Busing homeless people out of town. King County is about to triple its spending on that program, but supporters of busing people, homeless people out of town say it is not as heartless as the critics make it sound. So Hannah Scott, tell us about this.
So we've heard it for years, Dave, that many of those people living on the streets here in King County are not from here. Some homeless people even admit that to Cairo 7 TV.
People are coming from all over the world to Seattle. They Google Seattle specifically because we're the next New York City, Beijing, Hong Kong.
That fact and results from the latest King County one-night homeless count that found roughly 1,000 homeless people included in that count said getting help back to family would help them get into permanent housing is what prompted King County Councilmember Reagan Dunn to propose a homeward bound program earlier this year, similar to programs San Francisco and San Diego have that provide one-way bus tickets or train tickets out of town back to family. Dunn originally wanted about $1 million to invest in the program. For now, he's getting a smaller amount to get the ball rolling.
We passed through our supplemental budget for this year, and we were able to secure $100,000 for our family reunification program called Homeward Bound, which reunites homeless people with members of their family or close friends across the country where they can get a roof over their head.
Dunn says that $100,000 is a good start that will go a long way in his longer-term goal to expand the program. He also stresses this is not about just throwing homeless people on a bus and shipping them out of town, but a sincere effort to help and reunite them with their families.
The county will confirm that there is, in fact, somebody who is otherwise able to take care of them. They will have a conversation with that person, triage them, make sure that all the legal requirements are met before they ever get a chance to approve the ticket and move them forward.
So they actually do contact the family and say, your loved one is coming home.
That will be the idea with this extra $100,000. So right now, the county is spending about $37,000 spent across five different programs that help people with bus tickets, just, you know, pay for a bus ticket and send them home if they want. The idea here is to have a much more organized program where they do make sure.
So that it sticks. The relocation sticks.
Yeah. His legislation absolutely says you have to confirm we will not send them. We will not pay for their bus ticket unless we can confirm that their family is there on the other side and willing to take them in and help. Right. So as I said, there's five programs now. About $37,000 a year, this $100,000 nearly triples the effort.
Part of it's going to be used to coordinate the existing programs right now and promote them to the homeless community, make sure that folks know that they have this resource available to them and all expenses paid transportation to any region across the country. If they can get help there, we will pay for it. But also we want to measure the outcomes to make sure that this program is doing what we intended to do and continue to make improvements as we drive it forward.
So those are a couple of the interesting things here. This $100,000 is also going to pay for outreach. Part of the problem, he says, is that a lot of the folks living on our streets don't know that this is an option, don't know that they maybe could get this bus ticket. And then also really making an effort to track what happens once we give these folks this bus ticket.
We want to know in 6 months or a year how many people have benefited from this program, how many people have not benefited, how many people came back to Seattle, because about 1 in 8 down in California returned. So we're going to see some of that. But overall, is the program effective as part of our global strategy to reduce homelessness?
So the idea here is to use this $100,000 to get some outreach started, to get some tracking of the outcomes, and pay for some bus tickets, obviously. And then over the next several months, he and the county executive will work on kind of a design for a larger plan. And he says next year, when there's at the start of a new 2-year budget cycle, he plans to come back and ask for that much bigger ask to expand this program, assuming the results are what he believes that they will
be. They will actually track to see if it works.
Yes, absolutely. Because he wants to know, one, did you know, Are they doing better? But also he wants to know if they're coming back to Seattle.
Right. And are there people objecting to this, saying it's cruel?
There have been in the past, and even when he first voiced that, when he first proposed this earlier this year, there was a lot of criticism because people think you can't just, they think it's just throw him on a bus, ship him out of town, and there's nothing on the other side. It is not that, and that's something he really wants to make very clear. And I'll point out that this passed on a 7-2 vote yesterday in the council, where at the beginning, when he first started talking about this, there was a lot of hesitation. Mm-hmm. But folks are coming around, and because they're taking the slower approach to see what these outcomes are going to be.
That's where the process is supposed to work.
Yeah. And what do homeless people think about it?
I don't find anything wrong with it. If they got a place to stay, why not?
I love this state and all that, so I ain't moving, man. If I move, not yet.
And because I know you always like to ask this question, Dave, when might we see some results?
I think it'll start making a difference right after the holidays, and we'll drive it forward from there.
So we'll keep you posted.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
And today's Daily Dose of Kindness is the gift of music to a girl who, without the help of many people and technology, would never have been able to play the cello. This happened in Irving, Texas. A middle school music teacher went to a group of engineering students at Nimitz High School. Carly Addison wanted to help the student, Kayla Arquetta, who was born without a left forearm and hand, but wanted to play the cello, something that requires two hands to play.
Kayla came to our tryout night, and she told me that she wanted to be in orchestra.
I wanted to be in orchestra because I feel like I wanted to be different than my sibling.
Miss Addison came to me and said, we have this student who's missing an arm but wants to play the cello.
I started Googling, and I came across a young man who had been given a prosthetic because he was missing the lower half of his left arm, and he had played cello. And so I looked into who had designed it. It said Dr. Jennifer Mankoff. All of her designs were open to the public.
And Dr. Mankoff works with the Human Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon University, and her research has been associated with Microsoft, Google, and IBM. According to the Good News Network, she told Mrs. Addison she'd be happy to help. She provided blueprints that showed how to make a prosthetic using 3D printing technology. Well, that's when Addison got in touch with a local high school that had a 3D printer and helped her create a prosthetic for Kayla so that she could use it to hold the bow for the cello. Teams of the high school students not only made the prosthetic for Kayla, they're also taking the step further and finding ways to improve the device using different filaments to make it more comfortable for Kayla and more durable, lighter, and more fully functional with a greater range of motion. Kayla says she is thrilled with the new prosthetic, and she has a message for other kids, too.
I would like other students to know that life is challenging, but everyone's going to love you for who you are.
And the entire school district in Irving, Texas is celebrating the team effort and looking for more ways to use technology to help other kids.
There you go. That's a great story.
Time for the Sports Insider. Here is Stacy Rost from Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN. So, Stacy, the Astros have been the dominant team in the American League West. They continually frustrate us. And, yes, they're very talented, but it turns out they're very talented at cheating. So, what is the accusation here? How does this? How deep did this sign-stealing investigation go?
Oh, I love that delivery, Dave. It went pretty far, so much to where there's now a league investigation, and it's clearly illegal. So sign-stealing itself is not something a bit illegal. It dates back to the beginnings of baseball. It's really prominent in just any sport you go to. Jake Heaps, my co-host, talked about that sometimes a backup quarterback's job is to try to figure out, you know, the other team's plays or kind of decode what they're planning to do. It's just a competitive advantage people try to give themselves. But the NFL specifically, or the NFL, the MLB specifically outlaws the use of technology to do that.
Technology? Clearly, what were they doing?
Well, what they did was the Astros, according to a report where there are four witnesses, and then now there's all these videos kind of essentially proving it. They had a camera set up in center field, and that camera was fixed on the opposing catcher's sign. So the opposing catcher is kneeling, and he's signaling to the pitcher, you know, what pitch to throw.
I thought every team had its own secret, uncrackable, encrypted sign code.
Well, I mean, some of them are pretty similar, but then also you get so used to seeing the teams that you decode what they do, and it probably doesn't take too long to decode those signs and figure out, hey, when he does this and when the catcher, you know, shows, you know, this many fingers or gives this sign, it's an off-speed pitch or whatever. So they have a camera fixed to that, and then the feed is automatically relayed to the Astros clubhouse, and that's right behind the dugout.
Yeah.
And in there, employees and players are watching this screen, and they're trying to decode the signs.
Yeah.
And depending on the pitch that they see, this is the best part, they then bang on a garbage can if they think that it's going to be an off-speed pitch.
And
now,
that's how the batter hears it then.
Exactly. And so when you watch the videos, and just so for people that aren't big baseball fans, it basically, an off-speed pitch, knowing that it's an off-speed pitch versus like a fastball, would just mean that a batter can have an advantage with timing. And,
if they know it's a slower pitch. Yeah,
exactly.
He knows to hold off because you pretty much have to, if it's a fastball, you got to swing the moment it leaves the guy's hand, right? That's very,
so,
very sneaky.
It's very sneaky and very against the rules. And the reason that people are up in arms about it is no one really cares if you cheat and suck. But they cheated, allegedly, and won the World Series that year. And they were dominant. And so a lot of people are wondering, well, how much of this is because you cheated, which you, I mean, there are videos of it, and it's pretty hard to deny. And how much of it is because of how good you were? And what's kind of a shame is that they were really good. So they might have been able to get all the way without cheating. But I don't know. Does cheating invalidate your World Series? So that's the debate now.
Well, yeah. Well, yes, I would think it would. But how do they find, was there a whistleblower here?
There were essentially, there was it Danny Farquhar? There was a pitcher that was with the organization, that leaked that report. The Athletic found, which was the original report, Ken Rosenthal, he found also uncovered emails, an email from the assistant to the GM that essentially instructed people to, hey, don't forget to steal signs and use technology. Use the technology if you need to, is like a summary of what that email said. Which, by the way, I think we've learned, if you're going to commit crimes, don't email them. You know what I mean? Commit crimes off the record. If I'm encouraging any kind of crime committing to happen, just keep it safe.
I'm just amazed Major League Baseball could resolve this without having a week of all-day hearings. But I guess that's I guess that's good. So who's going to be punished? Is anybody going to be punished?
I don't know. I would think that they're going to be fined. So the closest thing that's kind of like this is the Red Sox, who a couple years prior were using Apple Watches, which is like, we get it. You have an Apple Watch. Cool. But they were using them to relay a similar thing. They were relaying signs to each other with it, and the MLB fined them, and they were punished. And that's when it was really an emphasis that no, you cannot use technology. It's like cheating at cheating. Like, you can't use technology.
So it's okay if the second baseman sees it.
Exactly.
And
if you're
going to
put in the hard work to steal signs,
but you shouldn't use
fine.
Technology.
No.
Well, what's next? Surveillance drones to see what the pitcher's grip is? I mean,
right?
That's crazy.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's also just bad news for the Astros because they're already in a heap of kind of bad PR news after their assistant GM was
getting into a reporter's face.
Exactly,
pitcher,
yelling at three female reporters, and then they just handled it so poorly. So it's already seen as an organization that's like a win-at-all-costs organization.
Yeah.
So I think people are more likely to believe it.
Our Sports Insider, Stacey Ross. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
Let's go.
Choke points.
Let's go.
That was smooth.
Thank you. Let's go. I'm always prepared in case the thing doesn't fire. I do my own. Hey ho.
I understand.
Choke point sponsored by Toyota of Puyallup, and this concerns a single traffic light, which is messing up I-5 near Arlington.
Yes, and it's a single traffic light that went in September, and it went into a spot that a lot of people have reached out to me and questioned. Listener Anna Murray said that there have been several near misses from people jamming on their brakes at the last second. While on I-5, because this new signal is backing up not only on Highway 530, but onto the northbound I-5 ramp to 530 and the northbound main line. And if you're unfamiliar with that area, you come down the hill out of like the Smoky Point area, the speed limit just gets raised to 70, and then you're coming down the hill and then bam, there you'll hit traffic that's somewhat you will unexpectedly there now backing up onto the freeway. Listener Michael Kernbach said that it's only a matter of time before somebody gets killed in a rear-ender there. Gary Hoffman told me that he's never remembered the traffic backing up onto the freeway in his 7 years living in that area. So I went up there. I checked it out this week. The signal is about a third of a mile from I-5, so it's very close. Okay, and this allows drivers on Smoky Point Boulevard a safe way to actually enter 530. There's also a new truck stop there, a brand new one that gets a ton of traffic, and it's added a lot of trucks to the mix as well that have to find a way onto 530 to get back onto I-5. So I sat down with Kristen Banfield with the City of Arlington, and she tells me that there are so many cars on that two-lane highway today, nearly 26,000 a day, that drivers entering the highway from that Smoky Point Boulevard virtually have no chance to do it safely.
Just closing their eyes and gunning for it and hoping that they got through because they got tired of having to wait for the amount of traffic that was already there.
And that truck traffic has just made the whole place even worse. Now, Banfield said there had been plenty of crashes and near misses at that spot even before this truck stop went in. There are businesses there. There are a couple of gas stations, a couple of restaurants as well. And she says that the traffic did back up onto I-5, or at least to the ramp, a little time before.
We know that that signal has exacerbated some existing conditions.
But she defends the decision to put the signal in.
We had a traffic safety issue where we had a number of collisions in that area. We also had a number of near misses, and those needed to be addressed, and they needed to be addressed quickly before we had further property damage and potential injury or loss of life.
Now, since that new signal went in 2 months ago, Banfield says there have not been any accidents at that spot. She says the Washington Department of Transportation has been tweaking the signal timing, not just on that temporary signal, but on the entire corridor to help with the congestion. And she says this is just a temporary idea.
The signal right now is just a temporary solution to be able to get traffic out onto 530 and off of 530 safely.
The permanent plan is to put a roundabout there at the spot where Smoky Point Boulevard joins in. Now, the city believes that's the best way to keep traffic moving safely, provide enough room for vehicles to access the highway, could also help with the backups onto I-5. But the project's going to cost $3 to $4 million. It's not currently funded. They hope to get the funding in the legislative session next session and then get this project done next summer. But there's concern that because of I-976, it's one of the projects that may not make the cut or will have to be cut back. And listener Hoffman told me that he's worried that this permanent fix is going to take way too long and, quote, hopefully somebody does not get killed in the meantime when they get rear-ended trying to exit onto I-5.
Could they just extend the exit lane into the breakdown lane?
Now, that's something earlier. And here's something that's also, and that's an astute point, because that exit ramp is short.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking super short because it was designed when Arlington was a place no one even thought about going to unless you were taking a long-term trip to your Christmas tree farm. It cannot handle the traffic there. And there isn't enough room for people to take lefts at the top of that lane to go west on Highway 530. And so people sit there and wait, and it backs up. So that's something that they could do, I think, in the interim, use that breakdown lane there to at least extend that. But still, you're coming down that hill at 70 miles an hour thinking you're going to get off at this really rural Highway 530 off-ramp, and it's just not really rural anymore. I mean, 26,000 cars a day is a ton of traffic on a road that was designed to handle, you know, basically guys running down the road with their tractors between Highway 9 and I-5, and that's just not the case. So many people have moved up there and are using that, something needs to be done there. This is the fix they've come up with to make it safer, but some listeners criticize that it's made conditions on I-5 less safe.
Yeah. And on Thursday mornings, we welcome the man who once ran the CIA, Michael Morell, who now hosts Intelligence Matters Saturdays on CBS and Cairo Radio. And, Mike, we were listening along yesterday to the ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, who was trying to make the case to the president and to the rest of us that our relationship with Ukraine is deeply important. It was very clear that President Trump did not share that. And this brings up what you're expected to do. If you are a career diplomat and you and basically everyone who works for you and supervises you is on board with the foreign policy, but the president is not.
Yeah, Dave, it's a great question. I think it's your responsibility to try to convince the president that he's not thinking about it correctly, that he's wrong, and you need to make your best effort to do that. Look, there were plenty of times when I was dealing with presidents where we had a particular view of an issue and they had a slightly different view or a completely different view. And we worked really hard at presenting evidence and analysis to try to convince them that we were right. And in some cases, we were successful, and in some cases, we weren't. But your responsibility is not to go around the president. Your responsibility is to try to convince him.
Okay. And if you now you say if you can't convince him, don't go around him. In what you've seen so far in the impeachment hearing testimony, did you see evidence of people deliberately going around the president, as much as they may have hated his policy, deliberately trying to undermine it?
No, what I watched the entire hearing yesterday, and what I heard was a diplomat who disagreed with a president on Ukraine, wanted to move forward on a number of fronts with Ukraine, and saw the president's very narrow interests in Ukraine, these political questions, tried to use those and deliver on those so that he could get what he wanted, which were the much broader strategic national security issues done. So I didn't see going around. I saw trying to deliver to the president what he wanted on the investigations in return to getting to where he and the rest of the national security community wanted to get to on our strategic policy. So I didn't see it going around. I saw it trying to play to the president to get what we thought was right.
But it sounds to me like there was at least one thing that was incompatible, that they were very, very concerned that President Zelensky was going to go ahead and make this public announcement, which the president was insisting on, a public announcement of an investigation mentioning the Bidens. They were worried that would show that Ukraine was either an American puppet or was weak, would portray that president as being weak in the eyes of his constituents at a very critical time, and also sending a signal to the Soviet Union that, maybe we can get away with our attempt to absorb this little country into Soviet Union 2.0.
Yeah, so if you look at the folks who were working the Ukraine issue, I think they fall into two camps. One camp, the Fiona Hill camp, and Fiona is testifying this morning, is exactly what you said. We don't want the Ukrainians to announce the investigations. It makes them look weak. I think Gordon Sondland, on the other hand, actually wanted them to announce the investigations to get rid of that as the roadblock to getting to where the foreign policy experts wanted to get to. So I think there are two different camps, those that were okay with the announcement of the investigations and those that clearly were not.
With all that we've seen now, do you see an impeachable offense there?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough question for me.
That's why I asked.
So I'm not a member of Congress. I don't have to make that decision. But here's what I see. I see a president of the United States who asked a foreign country to interfere in our elections. There is nothing more sacred than our elections. There is nothing more important to our democracy. So the quid pro quo is not as important to me as the simple ask to get involved in our politics. And I think that's a very, very dangerous thing. It's what the Russians did to us in 2016. Look at the effects that has had. So I think it's a very, very serious offense. Is it actually impeachable? We'll leave that to Congress.
Okay, but it's clear in your mind that it is serious. So that brings me to my next question. It's pretty clear that the only reason this is coming out now is because of a single CIA whistleblower.
Yes.
And it's also clear that all these people, everybody was in the loop, they all knew this was going on long before that phone call, and none of them spoke up. Is there anybody who you saw testifying who should have spoken up earlier?
They all should have.
They all should have.
This is really striking to me, is there were so many people who knew about this, and so many people who knew it was wrong. Even Gordon Sondland knew it was wrong, although he was willing to do it to get what he wanted. There were so many people that knew it was wrong. Why did it take a single CIA officer to be the one to stand up and say, stop? That is remarkable to me. It's not remarkable that a CIA officer did, because we're trained that way. We're trained to speak truth to power, to see the truth, to say the truth no matter what the outcome, no matter what the implications, no matter what the consequences. But what's amazing to me is that nobody else did. That's shocking to me.
Moving on to North Korea, you're going to be talking with a former CIA analyst, Sumi Terry.
Yes.
Who is an expert on North Korea. I get this North Korea newsletter. Well, from what I've been reading, Kim Jong-un is sounding like he's out of patience. He's doing these missile tests. He's sort of he doesn't want to meet with his South Korea counterpart quite as often. What is he trying to achieve here?
So he wants a deal with the United States whereby the vast majority of the sanctions that we have placed on them would go away, and he would not give up the entirety of his nuclear weapons program. He'd be able to keep part of it. That's what he asked for in Hanoi. That's what we said absolutely no to. That's what he still wants. And he hopes that these provocations that he's doing will frighten us into a deal where he gets most of what he wants and we don't get what we want.
Well, that's going to cause trouble. When does this next erupt into the news? Has the president said any further ultimatums? I haven't seen any, but
no. So Kim Jong-un has.
He's
really given the United States till the end of the year. He's put this out there. We'll give you to the end of the year to see things our way.
Or else what?
Well, he hasn't said that, right? But what I think the or else is a ramp up of the provocations, mm-hmm. perhaps a return to the testing of nuclear weapons, perhaps a return to the testing of ICBMs, mm-hmm. but ramping up the provocations to scare us back to the negotiating table. Because he thinks, Dave, that that's why we came to the negotiating table in the first place, was because he had done all those successful nuclear tests and ICBM tests.
Well, but the president has signaled he wants South Korea now to pay more for the troops, implying that if they don't, we might reduce our presence. What signal would that send?
So one of the things we actually talk about, Sue and I talk about on the podcast, is the state of relations between the U.S. and South Korea, which is not healthy. It's not it's not healthy because we are asking for five times. We're asking South Korea to pay five times what they're currently paying. We have significantly upped the request, and relations are not good, and that makes it more difficult to present a united front when you're dealing with North Korea. So that is actually very costly at the end of the day for our relationship with South Korea to be fraying at the same time we're trying to get North Korea in a box.
Former acting CIA Director Michael Morrell. Michael, thank you.
Welcome. Good to be with you.
All right. You can hear Michael's podcast, Intelligence Matters, Saturdays on Cairo Radio. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There is mindfulness everywhere. I've become extremely mindful of mindfulness itself, which is makes me super mindful. But it turns out that these mindfulness apps, this is according to Rachel Bell, who is my consultant on mindfulness, according to Rachel Bell, these mindfulness apps are actually creating more stress rather than less stress.
That's right. And when you say according to Rachel Bell, you mean according to an article Rachel Bell read by two Buddhism scholars. So yeah, the headline is in this Fast Company article, meditation apps are fueling tech addiction, not easing stress. So they found that there are more than 500 apps that are out now that are associated with Buddhism. There are two that are kind of at the top. One is called Headspace. One is called Calm. And these are meditation, I guess you could say meditation assistance apps. Everybody knows that meditation is hard. You know, everybody who's tried it and has struggled with it and stopped and said, oh, it's not for me. I have a monkey brain. We all have a monkey brain. You can't stop your thoughts. The whole point is that it is really hard and you're supposed to practice to get better at it.
Yeah.
Not that I have, because I have a monkey brain and it's hard. But the apps are supposed to make you, you know, somebody is guiding you instead of just having to sit on the floor in your living room and get distracted. You know, it's timed. It tells you when to start, when to stop. But in this article, they were saying that it's pretty counterintuitive. Number one, you know, looking at your cell phone a bunch of times a day, which we all do, causes stress, causes anxiety, causes depression in a lot of studies. They're saying just the act of using your phone and you're looking at it to do this adds to that stress. There was another article that Wired did that was more specific, and this I really related to. They said a lot of these apps, they track your meditation. So it's like you'll get a little ping. Good job. You meditated for 12 minutes today.
That's the problem. If they're scoring it,
that
reintroduces the anxiety.
Yeah. So they said they've gamified meditating. Yeah. And for a lot of people, you know, everybody who now tracks how many steps a day they walked, all that, you're competing either with yourself or somebody else, which completely defies the idea of Buddhism.
I mean, all this preoccupation with screen time. My phone is telling me you use this much screen time, that much screen time. And I realized, well, I do that instead of what I used to do, which was read a pile of books and magazines.
Yeah.
Right? So nobody thought that it was stressful to do that. I mean, we probably have 3,000 books in our house, and I got magazines upstairs. Just a reminder that to do this job, or actually just because I'm interested in it, I used to subscribe to 5-6 different magazines. And in my spare time, I would not just sit there and meditate. I'd go to that magazine. Today, it's screen time. I don't see the difference. I mean, if you're the kind of person who likes to be involved and likes to keep your mind active and you're not feeling stressed, you actually thrive on it, why not?
I think there is a difference. Number one, the light in the phone is different than reading a magazine or a book.
So they say.
So, well, I mean, people do have trouble sleeping because of it. So I think reading a book, it's easier to fall asleep.
Well, I've read myself to sleep with a magazine sometimes. It depends. I mean, if you want to go to sleep, don't read something interesting. Read something boring and you'll go to sleep.
Even on your screen.
That's right.
I think that, you know, the content can be different. I don't know how many people are exclusively reading books and magazines on their phone. I think the other thing is if you're reading a magazine or a newspaper and, you know, you could still get stressed about the content because it's bad news. I think it's still different than having a never-ending number of articles that you can click to on your phone, where it's just this up-to-date, this is what's happening in the world. You know, I think that that's what people get overwhelmed by.
Maybe, but there's always been a never-ending amount of information. The medium's been different, and the iPhone, any phone, is full of interruptions and diversions and digressions if you can't control it. But I go home every day and look in despair at the number of books in my bookshelf, which I will never read.
Hey, man, sell them. Then you could get new books.
Nobody wants them. They buy
them now by
the pound.
So what these people are saying to do, if you want to meditate, because meditating is proven to be very, very, very good for you, is to not use your phone to do it and just do it the old-fashioned way. Just sit down and just do it.
Which is to say, do nothing. Sit down and do nothing.
You've obviously meditated a lot.
That's right. That's why I'm so relaxed. Mm. Rachel Bell. Thanks, Rachel. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.